by any means necessary.
And we are extraordinarily happy to be joined here in our studio by Roger Waters, who is known to many of you, I'm sure, songwriter, bassist, co-founder of the legendary band Pink Floyd, also a great solo artist here touring the United States. I'm sure some of you listening here on 105.5 FM have probably already seen him here locally, and hopefully others will along his tour here in the United States. Mr. Waters, thank you so much for joining us here on By Any Means Necessary.
Couldn't be happier.
Well, you're here in Washington, D.C., and you've certainly perhaps the right place to be in a geopolitical storm here, and a lot of commentary coming around the statements you've made in support of BDS around the Palestinian issue, and, you know, there's a lot to cover there, but I wanted to start with a question that I'm always curious about when we talk about this conflict. What was your, how did you come to the Israeli-Palestinian issue? I mean, what was, is this something you've always known about? Was there a moment that woke you up? I mean, how did this become something that, you know, you felt strongly about?
Well, I came to it because a gig in Tel Aviv was tacked onto the end of a tour I was doing in 2006. It may even have been the Dark Side of the Moon tour. That's now 11 years ago, so I can't really remember. And suddenly there was this gig in Tel Aviv, and I confess I wasn't that focused. And of course, I immediately started getting emails, which I read and responded to. And inevitably, I'm chuckling now because since then, the guy who I started the conversation with has become a close friend, which is Omar Barghouti, who was, as you know, BDS had only just recently started in Palestinian civil society about a year before. And so I got into a conversation with him. This, by the way, to bring things up to date, being the conversation that Tom York wouldn't have with BDS. Mm. You know, he prefers not to talk to them about their desires and needs and their situation and so on. But I decided that I absolutely needed to talk to them. It sounded very relevant. So I did, and eventually I came to a weird compromise, which may or may not have been a good idea. I cancelled the gig in the stadium in Tel Aviv, but we moved it to a place called Neve Shalom or Wahat Asalam, which is an ecumenical agricultural community growing chickpeas halfway between Tel Aviv and Jerusalem, where many different races and religions of people live together and grow chickpeas to make hummus with. I assume that's what they make with the chickpeas. And the kids all live together and they all grow up together and they all go to the same school and so on. So it's a noble experiment in coexistence. And so we did the gig there instead, and it was hugely successful. There were 60,000 people all gathered. And everything was wonderful, except, of course, there were hardly any Palestinians there because they're not allowed to move anywhere. Everything was wonderful until the very end of the gig, when at the end of the gig, I made a little speech to the audience, and they went from being ecstatic, sort of Pink Floyd / Roger Waters fans, to being silent, not understanding, uncomprehending Israelis. And it was when I said, you are the generation of young Israelis who are going to have to make, you know, amends with and friends with your neighbors, or you're all... Anyway, when I said that, they went, what's he talking about? We were having a lovely rock concert here. Why does he have to mention the P word? You know. So I felt very, very uncomfortable after that experience. And so the next year I went back at the invitation of UNRWA and a woman who was running it there in Jerusalem called Allegra Pacheco. And they took me everywhere, not just all around Jerusalem, where I was, you know, sort of molested and maligned by settlers in Jerusalem. This is 2007.
Right.
And I went to, you know, Bethlehem and to the refugee camps. And then we drove all over the West Bank. So I saw a lot of settlements and outposts and checkpoints. And I sat down with the elders in Jenin in the refugee camp. And somehow I got involved with Markus Vetter, this German filmmaker who made the movie Heart of Janine, and with Ismail, who was the father of the kid who was killed. I don't know if anybody knows, but Heart of Janine is a documentary about a Palestinian, 9-year-old Palestinian boy who was killed in Janine by the Israeli, by the IDF. And after a lot of toing and froing, he was on life support for a bit, but he was brain dead. His parents and the local resistance and the local imam and everybody agreed that his body parts might be used for the saving of life. Mm. And so they went all over, you know, his heart went somewhere, which is what the movie's about, and his kidneys and his liver and his lungs and blah, blah, blah. And many of the bits went to Israeli families. And so they follow the story. It's a remarkable document. I get a bit emotional even remembering it now. Where was I? So after that, I thought, well, I have to do what little I can to shed light on this situation. So I learned more about the history. And I also subsequently learned that my father had, when he finished his teacher training education in the 30s, in the mid-30s, the first post that he took was at St. George's School in Jerusalem. Wow. And he was there in 34 and 35 and 36 before he left and came back. So there was a connection there as well. And he was already in the 30s. He wrote a letter to my grandmother saying how concerned he was at how at the Zionist movement and how the land was being bought up with a lot of American money. And he was concerned about the potential fate of the indigenous Palestinian people, who at the time were a majority, 90% of the people living in the land. So, you know, all those years later, a few years later, when Golda Meir was saying, you know, a land with no people is just a barefaced lie.
Right.
There were a lot of people there.
That's
been
for sure.
For a long time.
That's absolutely, that's certainly for sure. And not the only lie that's been told, certainly in the service of that cause. You know, one thing I'm always curious about, especially people who, like yourself, have a higher profile, who've been criticized for embracing BDS, are you ever surprised with the vitriol behind it? Because, I mean, boycott, divestment, sanctions. Here we have a nonviolent movement steeped deeply in so many of the, you know, Martin Luther King, Gandhi, I mean, so many people who are so revered worldwide. But when you put BDS, Israel together, I mean, it's the vitriol directed towards it seems so out of whack with sort of how we're taught to remember nonviolent civil disobedience and the importance of that sort of moral crusade in different contexts. Are you ever surprised by that level of vitriol?
Yeah, I mean, they're hugely well organized. It's the completely understandable bitterness that followed the way that the Jewish people were treated in Northern Europe and Western Europe in the 30s and 40s and during the Second World War, has somehow been diverted into an exceptionalist extremism that knows no boundaries of behavior, particularly in terms of AIPAC, for instance, in this country, where they are terrified that anybody might discover the real narrative of what actually happened in 1947 and 48 and what the history has been since. So in order to draw the picture that they want people to understand or to believe of Israel as this tiny outpost of democracy and freedom and goodwill toward men and whatever, which clearly is not what it is, but that's the picture that they want to sell. And if somebody suggests that there might be an alternative narrative, they want them silenced. So they want to reduce anybody who has been there and actually experienced the oppression of the Palestinian people firsthand. And they will stoop to the lowest, wherever they have to go, they will go. You know, in D.C., we did two gigs here last week, and they were great. The audience were wonderful, the audiences that we had. There was a lot of love in the room. It's very encouraging. Actually, I've been finding this all over, everywhere we've played so far, and we're about 30 gigs in. I said to the audience the other night, I said, there's a lot of love in this room and there's a lot of love in this country. It just needs to allow itself to rise to the surface so that it can interfere with whatever the scum is that's on the surface at the moment, which is what the rest of the world sees. But I have a lot of friends in DC because I've done work here with people from Walter Reed. I've worked with wounded men a bit. No, and we don't do politics, the wounded guys and I. We play music together, and it's I did a gig in Daughters of the American Revolution Hall here, which I called Music Heals, a couple of Novembers ago. And that was a very moving experience as well. I only bring these guys up because there's something that I haven't been public with before, but I think maybe this is the correct forum because we're in DC. I did some gigs with these men who I met at Walter Reed through a guy there called Arthur Bloom, who runs a program called Music Corps, which is to help rehabilitate wounded veterans. And we worked for Bob and Lee Woodruff, who have a charity called Stand Up for Heroes. And it's just to raise money to help some of these guys, because whatever you think of the foreign policy that sent them into harm's way, you have to see them as victims in the same way that all people wounded in conflicts are, to at least some extent. However misguided they may have been for going there or whatever, it's very easy to become indoctrinated and get all rah-rah and what is quoted as being patriotic and exceptionalist and believing, well, we're the greatest country in the world and we have to go and tell everybody else how to behave. So Stand Up asked me if I would do some gigs in New York. They have a charity raising gig every year. I am denied a bit. It felt a bit weird to go and be showing off and, playing rock and roll with these guys who are badly, badly damaged, injured, amputees and so on. But then I had an idea, so I said to the board, what about if I go down to Walter Reed and put a band together of these blokes? Then it would feel cool. So they went, what? And anyway, they agreed. So we did it, to cut long story short. So we did it, and we did a gig in 2012 at the Beacon in New York, and it was great. And it was very moving working with these guys and with Arthur Bloom there. So the next year we did it in a bigger place. It was the theater upstairs at Madison Square Garden. Boom. So we're two in. The next year, it's the middle of the summer and I'm thinking, I haven't had the phone call. Well, the gig is always first week in November. So I started to smell a rat. I thought there's something wrong here. I looked into it and of course eventually I found out what it was. And what it was they didn't want to tell me. And I'm laying no blame on Bob and Lee Woodruff, who are wonderful, wonderful people, and it's perfectly decent. Two or three or four of the main sponsors of the event for the next year had come to, all Jewish, of course, had come to them and said, if Roger Waters plays at the gig, you'll never see another penny from any of us ever again. Now, that is low. That, I've never been so angry in my life as I was in that moment, and shocked beyond belief. So eventually I shared that with the men, and we decided that we were going to put on our own show the next year, which we did, which was the one that we did here in DC. That is the depths to which they will sink. They've done it to me in other charities. I was involved in a charity in New York distributing food to hungry people in New York. People in New York, richest country in the world, people are hungry. We know people are hungry all over this country because that's the way it's organized. And it's wrong. And that's what that's what this is all about. So I was going to play at their annual fundraiser. Same thing. Three people on the board. If he plays, not a dollar. So they use their financial muscle to marginalize me and also to prevent me from giving my services to people who are in need, which is despicable.
And we're going to take a break on that note, but we will be back with more with Roger Waters here on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier. Stay with us.
By any means necessary.
شلحونا للبلاد، حلب المدمن، شلحونا الهوية.
And that was Jawan Safadi and Tamar Nafar. They are Palestinian artists, and that is their song, Awal Bawal, and I think a excellent note to come in on as we continue to be joined by Roger Waters, who is a singer, songwriter, bassist, and composer, the co-founder of the legendary rock band Pink Floyd, and also a great solo artist in his own right, here to talk with us today about his decision to speak out on boycott, divestment, and sanctions, and the situation in Israel-Palestine. Roger, thank you for continuing to be joined by us.
Couldn't be happier.
You know, it's one of those things that I think is also interesting about BDS as a movement as well, because I think it speaks sort of directly to the point you're making, and I'm curious if you agree with this general point, is that it attacks that sort of, you know, the ability for people to use these sort of cultural manifestations, economic manifestations, and different things like that to tip the scales in their favor. I mean, I think it really acts in a way to help balance the scales internationally as much as it possibly can be done by sort of raising not only the issue in a way, but really putting that material pressure on a force that, you know, makes people sit up and take notice.
Well, what's raising the issue right now, of course, is the fact that AIPAC are trying to criminalize BDS, and by and large, so far, they have done so successfully, and that there is a bill in Congress, sponsored, among others, by Kirsten Gillibrand, who's the junior senator from New York, the aim of which is to make any cooperation with BDS, boycott, divestment, and sanctions, a criminal offense in the United States. So on the altar of Zionism, they want to tear up the Constitution. They want to scratch out the First Amendment, take away all rights of free speech, not just from all your citizens, but also from a concerned foreigner like myself, who happens to live here and work here. So we're arriving at a fundamental crunch point where your civil liberties are being attacked by what is essentially an agent of a foreign government. Because these people, AIPAC and ADL and the other extremist Jewish lobby organizers, or Israeli lobby, I shouldn't say Jewish because it's nothing to do with Judaism or Jewish people. In fact, many, many of my friends in this country are very active with Jewish Voice for Peace and other organizations because they understand that these policies and the policies of the Israeli government and the Zionist movement do not represent the fundamental tenets of Judaism, which is at heart as humane as any of the other religions or any of the other Judeo, Middle East-centric religions that have grown up in the last couple of thousand years. So we are an absolute watershed. They're trying to cancel my gig at Nassau Coliseum in Long Island, in 3 weeks' time. Yeah. Local councillors and are speaking to newspapers, and even the state attorney has gone public saying he is considering whether to make a legal attack upon my gig at Nassau Coliseum in 3 weeks' time. I kind of hope he does, because it would give those of us who believe in personal freedom and believe in the rule of law, and also believe in boycott as a legitimate, non-violent protest tactic, it would give us a chance, A, to have our voice in public, because you won't see me on Colbert or Charlie. I used to be appearing on Charlie Rose until they said, no, you can't have him. You won't see me on mainstream television. Well, I did a little thing on CNN. Because I was attacked in Florida, they wouldn't let the kids that I had got to come and sing Brick 2. I have a dozen local children, wherever we perform, come and become part of the show. And the local mayor forbade them appearing on the show because some Jewish organization, some Israeli-orientated organization. Well, actually, no, they call themselves a Jewish foundation for something or other, accused me of being anti-Semitic and saying I was spreading hatred and so on and so forth. It's the big lie. Anyway, this bill, we all have to stand shoulder to shoulder and say, no. And we have to protect our right to boycott. You know, it worked with Dr. King. It worked in South Africa. And let us not forget that this is, and this is something that Radiohead said when they were saying, we're going to go and play there anyway. And why don't you boycott the United States? You don't agree with their foreign policy. The people of the United States have not asked me to come and boycott the United States. The people of Palestine have. The whole of Palestine civil society in 2005, 2006, made a general international appeal to artists, activists, politicians, anybody there was, to help them in their cause and to help shine a light on their predicament by joining the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. It is a request from the people who are occupied. In exactly the same way that the boycott of South Africa back in the 80s and 90s was at the request of the ANC, it was at the request of the vast majority of South African people. So when an oppressed people ask you from foreign countries to join them in their struggle for basic human rights, which is all BDS is about, we're not asking for the destruction of Israel. We're not asking for anything that could be accused of being even faintly anti-Semitic in any way. We are asking that all the people of the region have the same political, civil, and religious rights. And that's pretty simple. And of course they say, no, we don't want them to have rights. We want rights for us. We want the rights to only be for people who are Jewish in Israel and in the occupied territories as well.
Well, so, and I would just say, and notable here, just historical fact for people who want to know, another brick in the wall, famous Pink Floyd song, many people know, banned by apartheid, South Africa at one point, who thought it was too rebellious. And I'm curious how you, and I know there's one organization here in the D.C. area that even made a video calling you an anti-Semite to try to get it out there, to try to make it difficult for you to perform. I mean, it seems that, you know, it has an extra pernicious bite to it because it speaks to the people whose, you know, heart cries out for justice, who would never want to be associated with anti-Semitism or anything like that. And that it's just such an easy way to disengage from the conversation about right and wrong, to just throw that label, because then people say, well, hey, I don't want to be associated with that. And rightfully so, of course.
Well, they've discovered that the tactic has been successful, and that's why they use it. And they use it for exactly the reason that they do not want to engage in the dialogue. Because whenever they engage in the dialogue, they don't have any moral or righteous ground to stand on. You know, what the Israeli government has done since 1947, 48, and through in the 67 war and the occupation, particularly the occupation and the settler movement, is completely illegal under international law and is clearly deeply humane, deeply divisive, and deeply exceptionist. They are operating under, look, we are more important than you. We're better than you. Our rights are more important. You don't count. You are subhuman people. We're not. And we're above you, which is completely unacceptable in any part of the world or any society that wants to call itself civilized. No, and not just in my view, in the view of all progressive thought would agree upon that point. As people tell me constantly, I get trolls on websites and things saying, why doesn't he just shut the F up and play his songs? Mm. Hang on, let me think. How long have I been writing political songs? 50 years. The fact is that I'm going to say it now. Dr. King, in the day, I'm quite sure people were saying, why doesn't he just shut the F up and go back to preaching about God? That's his job. This is none of his business. We'll decide who can ride where on what buses and use what drinking fountains and whatever. It's none of his business. Shut up. Well, no, it is his business. And this is my business. So it's a... that's a non-operative argument as well, in my view.
And the final thing I just wanted to raise here is, I think the flip side of a lot of what we sort of see in terms of, I think, what I view Israel's very effective use of soft power is that it also sort of eliminates the idea, like, you know, you don't hear a lot about Palestinian artists and cultural production and so on and so forth. And as someone who has this platform and obviously has an unbelievable musical background, do you also see this as a good opportunity to raise that issue as well, that there's so much about Palestine that we don't see, from the artists to the musicians and so on and so forth?
Well, of course. Yeah. I've written this often, but, you know, they are an ancient people with a huge tradition of literature and scholarship and philosophy and all kinds of artistic endeavor that is completely ignored, because at the behest of the lobby, the United States has decided to label them terrorists. So Palestinian terrorist, it's all the same thing. These are just violent, unpredictable, you know, people who we must just control at all costs in order to protect this colony or satellite or whatever it was, or home for the Jewish people after the Holocaust, whatever picture you want to paint of Zionism. And it's deeply distressed. I mean, it's quite amazing how Palestinian culture has survived through the last 70 years. It just shows how resilient the people are and how philosophical. Everybody always says, and they're quite rightly, just imagine if it was you. Imagine if you had to live, any one of us. Imagine if we were living under a military occupation. Just imagine for a second if Washington, D.C. had a foreign army in it and there were soldiers on every street corner and you could not walk from here to the river because there are checkpoints, and only these foreigners or these people who've occupied your land are allowed to walk to the river. You're not allowed to go to the river. You can't go to the sea. You're completely restricted in every way. The lights go on and off because they decide when the lights can go on and off. You know, the stench of human feces fills your, if you're a Gazaan, fills your nostrils wherever you are, all day, every day. Your children's lives are kind of considered worthless to the occupier. Imagine how it would feel, even for 10 minutes. Mm. It's beyond belief that there hasn't been, you know, a complete bloodbath. What's happening every day is a bloodbath, because young women would go to their mother's sewing basket and take out a pair of scissors and go and commit suicide by running at a heavily armed Israeli soldier with a pair of scissors, with no hope of inflicting any damage on them. It's a symbolic act, and it's a suicidal act, because they shoot them dead on the spot. They wouldn't have to. Obviously, they could clearly disarm a child with a pair of scissors. Right. And then if you were a civilized country, what would you do with that child? You'd maybe take them into protective custody and try and give them counseling or whatever, except that you would then have to ask yourself the question, why is a child running at me in full body armor, carrying a A-17 or whatever they shoot them with a pair of scissors? There must be a reason. What could it possibly be? Duh. You know, it's not rocket science. Right. They feel like you would feel if it was being done to you. It makes me think of Charles Kingsley, you know, as a famous English author who wrote a book called The Water Babies. And it's a strangely kind of metaphysical but cautionary tale. But in it, there are two characters. And one of them is very famous in English literature and is rooted in our psyche. And it's a woman, and she's called Mrs. Do As You Would Be Done By, which is, it's the old kind of biblical thing, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Well, if we were to apply that as a general rule, not just to the Israelis or to Zionism, but to our own foreign policy, how would you feel? How would you feel here in Washington, D.C., if the sky was full of drones and you never had any idea whether you were going to be blown to bits, whatever you were doing? What right do these people flying these drones, probably sitting in an airfield in wherever it is, when you're in the Yemen, they're probably sitting in Nevada, right, you know? By what right are these people droning all day and night? How would you feel?
I think that's a fantastic note to end on. Roger Waters, thank you so much for joining us here. You are on the Us and Them tour right now here in the United States. Hopefully folks who are listening can have the opportunity to check that out. But thank you again for joining us here on By Any Means Necessary and being willing to. Thank you for having me.